I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. A ceremony today marked the beginning of construction for a memorial on the site of the 2013 Center City, Philadelphia building collapse. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that the monument is designed to remember the six people killed and send a message.
Walk with me, my brother.
Mayor Jim Kenney and family members of those who died in the June 2013 building collapse used silver shovels to officially break ground for the June 5th Memorial Park. The mayor says the 22nd and Market Street Memorial will remind developers that cost should never be a priority over human lives.
The best way to memorialize the people who lost their lives here is to never allow it to happen again and to take the measures necessary to make sure it doesn't happen.
Nancy Winkler, who lost her daughter, spoke for the family, saying the park will be a symbol now and forever.
By remembering those who died here, the memorial will serve as an enduring reminder that no land development plan, no parking lot, no office tower, and profit that they may generate is more precious than a human being.
City Managing Director Michael DeBerardina says the park will honor those who perished in the tragedy.
There's times in the life of a city where we have to remember and respect and honor folks in a special way, and I think this park will do that.
Jerry Sweeney, CEO of the Brandywine Realty Trust, says the development and labor community also did a great deal to make the memorial happen.
This memorial park will take its rightful place in the city as a reminder that development must be done safely and must be done responsibly.
The Salvation Army donated the property for the memorial, and nearly $1 million worth of labor also has been donated. The park is expected to be finished by fall. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
This disclosure, Jerry Sweeney is a member of WHYY's Board of Directors. Democratic presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are campaigning in Philadelphia today, with less than 3 weeks before the Pennsylvania primary. WHYY's Katie Colinari reports that a new Quinnipiac poll shows Clinton leading Sanders in Pennsylvania by 6 points.
Thank you.
Seeming energized after losing to Bernie Sanders in Wisconsin, Hillary Clinton spoke to hundreds of union members at the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO's annual convention in Philadelphia. Unions have been some of her strongest supporters, and she touched on several issues important to them, raising the minimum wage and rejecting trade deals that could hurt workers. Clinton also made a promise.
If I'm fortunate enough to be elected president, organized labor will always have a champion in the White House and a seat at the table.
Although the audience gave her a warm welcome, Clinton took the time to criticize Sanders' ability to fulfill his campaign promises.
I am concerned that some of his ideas just won't work because the numbers don't add up.
Sanders will also speak to the same convention. The state chapter of the AFL-CIO has not endorsed a presidential candidate yet, and the National Federation of Unions has opted to stay neutral so far. Before Clinton came to the stage, Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, called for unity. The AFT has endorsed Clinton, but Weingarten said she would tell her members to support Sanders should he become the nominee.
And I'm asking every member of this audience to do the same. Because the stakes are too high this time to play any kind of protest vote game.
With 210 delegates at stake here, it's likely Clinton and Sanders will make many more Pennsylvania campaign stops before the April 26th primary. I'm Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
At this hour, Hillary Clinton's rival for the Democratic nomination, Bernie Sanders, is also in town, holding a rally at Temple University. We'll have coverage of that event tomorrow on Morning Edition. The campaign for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania is heating up, with attacks over Social Security and outside groups spending money to influence the race. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
Former Congressman and Navy Admiral Joe Sestak came into the race with a lead-in name recognition from his 2010 Senate run and his travels around the state. But former State Environmental Secretary Katie McGinty entered the fray and quickly won endorsements from Labor and Democratic Party leaders. She's trailed Sestak in the polls and has begun attacking him on Social Security. She went after him at a debate this week in Pittsburgh.
And I do disagree with Congressman Sestak. He has said that it was courage and the proper thing to do to call for the Social Security retirement age to be lifted to 69 and significantly cut benefits.
McGinty was referring to Sestak's comments about the Simpson-Bowles plan for reducing the national debt and ensuring Social Security won't be hurt by shifting demographics. It's a plan McGinty's own campaign chairman, Ed Rendell, has praised. Sestak came back quickly in the debate.
I never, ever advocated, in fact, have gone on radio and television, that actually we should never raise, never, the age of our seniors to retire.
What Sestak did say in January was that people should look at the National Commission, which compiled the Simpson-Bowles proposals, as a template to address the problem of funding entitlements. There's a third candidate in the race, Braddock, Pennsylvania Mayor John Fetterman, who says he spent 10 years fighting for progressive change on the ground. He has less campaign money but is producing ads, many featuring him driving through Braddock and addressing issues such as fracking.
These gas companies with billions in revenue and profits don't pay a single dime to Pennsylvania for the gas that they extract from our state, and that's outrageous.
Fetterman says he'll pick up momentum and win. Meanwhile, the race has another feature common to modern campaigns.
Get up, get to school, get to work, get by. Katie McGinty knows the routine. Her dad was a Philly cop. Mom worked in a restaurant.
That appealing bio ad didn't cost the McGinty campaign a cent. It was funded by the super PAC of the feminist abortion rights group Emily's List. Another super PAC called Accountable Leadership is supporting Sestak. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
The market's actually working in favor of those who are trying to put an end to gas drilling in Pennsylvania. A steady dip in natural gas prices has led companies drilling in the state to lay off workers and shut down operations. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports that former drilling hotspots are now seeing big changes in the local economy.
At Jerry Lee's Emporium in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania, there's a handwritten sign on the front door.
Store closing for good.
Jerry Lee Edwards opened the store in 2014. He came from southern West Virginia to tap into Pennsylvania's booming Marcellus shale industry to sell clothes to oil and gas workers.
But this is mainly the heart of the business. The fire-resistant coveralls, pants, jeans, and work pants.
Edwards sells other stuff, too. CDs, knickknacks, and flags, including the Mexican flag, the Marine Corps flag, and yes, the Confederate flag.
I'm about the only one in the area that handles the rebel flags because of the controversy, and I do very well with them. I've sold over 1,000 rebel flags in this area alone.
Before coming to Waynesburg, Edwards sold his wares to coal miners in West Virginia. But that industry was suffering, so he moved north to Pennsylvania. Business was good for a few months.
For the first 6 months, fabulous. Then it just started going down and down and down.
Business got so bad, Edwards decided to close his shop this spring. A lot of others who have tied their fortunes to the fracking industry are having to make similar recalibrations. Low natural gas prices have led fracking companies to slash budgets and lay off workers. State records show Pennsylvania lost 10,000 jobs in the industry. And it's having an impact. Robbie Matisic is head of economic development for Greene County, one of the biggest drilling areas in the Marcellus Shale. Sitting in her office in downtown Waynesburg, she said the difference between now and a few years ago is audible.
My goodness, in 2010 and in 2011, we wouldn't have been able to have this conversation here so close to the street because it was just constant traffic.
Matisic said when the boom started about 5 years ago, there was an influx of workers into the county.
All of a sudden, we saw most of the traffic that went through this town was from Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas, Colorado, Utah.
The county benefited from that activity. It's gotten millions of dollars in drilling fees that have gone towards roads and bridges, sewers, and social services. Matisic said locals also got jobs, with businesses that supplied the drilling rigs and pipeline crews. Restaurants and hotels were also full, and savvy local businesses began catering to oil and gas workers as they passed through.
Yeah, we have six spots down here at the bottom.
Joel Kovach manages Rohanna's Golf Course just outside Waynesburg. About 5 years ago, Rohanna's added an RV park. The company cleared a patch of roadside and put in hookups for 30 RVs to cater to oil and gas workers. The spaces filled up, and for a while, they had a waiting list.
I'd say it was at least 10 to 15 spots deep, and those people needed somewhere to stay.
Today, though, only 8 of the 30 RV spots are filled. The rest of the lots stand empty.
It's been like this for probably 6 to 9 months now, to where there's not too many people.
Kovach thinks business will pick up again in the future. As for Edwards, the shop owner who's closing up, he doesn't think he can wait that long.
They say it'll come back in 2 or 3 years. I'm 73 years old. I'm not waiting 2 or 3 years for it to maybe come back.
He's actually heading to the U.S. Virgin Islands, where he'll work as a music promoter. It's not a bad fallback. But for those sticking around in Greene County, most are getting used to what looks like the end of the boom times. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Still ahead, an immigrant family finds its life defined by the Philly neighborhood where members first landed.
We lived on Broad Street. That was our lifeline. That really oriented my family to a very specific geographic life.
Stay tuned for Story Corner as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Off-Broadway last year, a play called An Octoroon was hailed as a new masterpiece of extremes, and tickets were hard to come by. Wilma Theater in Center City is producing it now, and NewsWorks Theater blogger Howard Shapiro says An Octoroon earns its reputation for breakthrough storytelling.
Brandon Jacobs Jenkins' wildly extreme play, An Octoroon, is about two things he cleverly ties together: the way we buy into theatrical illusion and the way we traffic in racial stereotypes. It's a piece of unlikely storytelling and challenging theater, too. The play shifts directions and moods in a flash. Once you buy into these jarring rhythms, An Octoroon strangely begins to make sense. It starts off with a black playwright who complains he can't find enough white actors for a production of his new play. Then, on comes a long-dead Irish playwright to tell us that he can't find an American Indian for a role in his new play. Next thing you know, the black playwright's putting on white face, the Irish playwright's putting on red face, and his assistant is putting on black face. Sound confusing? It's supposed to be. What follows is the black playwright's take on the Irish playwright's work. This melodrama is set on a failing Louisiana plantation. The dialogue is shocking, especially when it involves race. And it's outrageous, and so funny that it exposes itself for its utter absence of rationale. One of Jacobs Jenkins' great gifts is his ability to play with storytelling. In one scene, the two playwrights lament the artificial devices that traditionally make plots work and that audiences buy into. Then they move on with the remainder of their trite play, which, of course, we buy into. The accomplished director, Joanna Settle, who is chief of the University of the Arts Theater Program, introduces unnecessary confusion into the first half of An Octoroon. She has the hip-hop band Il Dutes interrupting the action with songs that seem to have no relationship to an unfolding plot that's already complicated. But in the second half, she finds her footing. The gamely cast is large and headed superbly by professional Philadelphia actors James Iams, Ed Swidey, and Justin Jane. Their jobs are tough, and so is this splendid play. An Octoroon runs through April 10th at Wilma Theater. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
This evening, for Story Corner, we join forces with our series, Every Zip Philadelphia. There are 48 zip codes in Philly, and each one tells a story. Tonight, our tale takes place in Olney, near the northern end of the Broad Street line, zip 19141. That's where Fred Pingwell grew up in the 1990s as an undocumented immigrant from the Philippines. He shared this story with a live audience at Arts Sanctuary about his family's struggles and the relief they received from an unexpected source.
I'm an immigrant. We came over to the United States in 1992. My mom told me that we were going to go to Disneyland, and we just never went home. That was how my family came over. My dad came over here and got a job. My mom and I came over to see Mickey. And then my older brother came a little bit later after us. We were undocumented. You know, we overstayed tourist visas, so we didn't have any access to any kind of institutional support when we got here. Didn't have social security numbers, didn't really have a path to citizenship until much later on. And so that can really complicate things, like getting a job or going to school or getting groceries is really complicated. And that was how we started our lives here in the United States. Our very first apartment was up at Broad and Olney, and it's the second to the last stop on the Broad Street line, right across the street from the Olney bus terminal. That really oriented my family to a very specific geographic life. We lived on Broad Street. That was our lifeline. And we took the Broad Street line to school, to work. We walked up Broad Street to go shopping at the Thriftway. We did not have a car. It's a really poppin' part of town. There's a lot of traffic, foot traffic, bus traffic, cars. And so my parents wanted to move us away from there, and so we wound up moving to Somerville. It moved us two blocks away from Broad Street, just far enough to make it complicated for us to maintain these patterns that we'd started. So we started going to this grocery store right on Front and Olney. That was how we would spend our Sundays. We would, you know, go to church, and then we would have lunch at the Burger King, and then we would go to Caldor, and then my brother and I would go to Funko Land, and then we would wrap up the day by going to the supermarket. So when we got to the ShopRite, my family would just throw half of the supermarket into the cart. Corned beef, Spam, bread, milk, cheese. And so that was dope, buying all of this stuff, and then we'd have to go home. And that's when it got a little complicated. Walking that mile and a half back to our house, now with $100 worth of groceries, to get that back to where we lived was a struggle. And the complicated thing isn't really the walk, it's that what it signified. Because when we got home, we still had homework to do, we still had dinner to cook, we still had laundry to fold, uniforms to iron, all of the stuff on top of this belabored walk. And you might ask yourself, why didn't you guys just get a car? And one, we couldn't afford it. And the second thing was that it was really hard for us to figure out, how do you get a license? How do you get car insurance? And maybe if we had been able to plug into an existing community of folks, we could have figured that out. But we didn't do that. So we had to figure it out on our own. And we were just too busy trying to live. And so we did that walk until one day this elderly gentleman comes up and he says, do you guys need a hack ride? And my mom says, ano sinasabi niya? And so what she was asking is, what's he saying? And I said, told my mom, I think he's trying to offer us a ride. My dad started talking to this gentleman and found out his name was William. And he offered hacks on the weekends as a way of making extra income. And they negotiated a price, $5, to give my family and our groceries a ride back to the crib. What it did was it opened up the rest of that day for my family. And so for the next 2 or 3 years, William became an intrinsic part of our experience here in the United States. I don't know if he ever knew that. Whenever there were any job interviews, any doctor's appointments, any government appointments where we didn't know how to get somewhere, William was there. And that was a good look, because being undocumented in this country is very isolating. It's very marginalizing. It's like you're on a lifeboat. You know that there's a shore out there you're trying to get to. And so you gotta push yourself, you gotta push your crewmates to try and make it to that shore. If you do it on your own, those boats don't usually make it. The ones that do are the ones who find these little lifelines. People who cross boundaries, either willingly or unknowingly, to give us a hand. William was one of those people. I'd hope that he understood in you how much he meant to us and how much he meant to me. And I'm really happy that I got a chance to share his story with y'all today.
Fred Pingwell is a Philadelphia-based community organizer and activist. Every Zip Philadelphia is part of Finding America, a national initiative produced by AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, with financial support from the Wincote Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from the intrepid Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.